We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
We don't have government of the people, by the people, for the people. We have government of the people, by the bureaucrats, for the bureaucrats.
You don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat. You can be whatever you want to be. Just go and fight for your beliefs and be as independent as you can.
Well, it's been a very busy week in politics. We've had the, I can't say shocking, but at least the end of the impeachment proceedings. Maybe not their legacy, but the proceedings are over. President Trump has been exonerated by the Senate, or perhaps acquitted would be a better term, because this was the headline of the newspapers he bore with him to the National Prayer Breakfast, not even a week later, that has been causing, shall we say, some stirs. We've talked previously on the podcast about President Trump's evangelical support, and I'm not sure I can say it's reached a head at this point, because I'm sure more will come up with the election. But certainly, his support among evangelicals and among Christians in general has once again entered the news. So once again, I've brought back Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Snarkiness's own Costco brand Richard John Neuhaus, my friend seminarian and pastor in training for like one more month, David Keating, to talk about these issues. So, David, thanks so much for coming on to the podcast again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's going to be good to try to unpack some of this stuff and see what's going on in Trump
land. So just going briefly over President Trump's remarks and what he was responding to, and we'll be linking to these in the show notes. But the speaker at the prayer breakfast does have a long history of not necessarily being ideologically aligned with the current president. Ben Carson spoke when President Obama was the president, for example. Mother Teresa spoke against abortion when Bill Clinton was president. So they're, it's not like the president picks someone who's just on his ideological line. And this year's speaker was Dr. Arthur Brooke. He's an independent, or self-described independent. Anyway, he's played both sides of the aisle before. He's Roman Catholic, so he is Christian. And his background is very much in the free market. He's the former president of the American Enterprise Institute, for example. And his big message was about polarization in politics. And I really appreciated it myself, actually, because he talked about how in Christian belief, Jesus says that we must meet evil with love. This is present in the Gospels, it's present in the Epistles. It's a very Christian idea. And he even said, you know, liberals and conservatives, we have different approaches to faith, but we shouldn't necessarily demonize each other. I was very much reminded of Jonathan Haidt's moral foundations theory that liberals and conservatives share an equal concern for morality, that is to focus it differently. And what Brooke kept saying throughout his speech was, you know, we need to love our enemies and pray them, you know, pray for them. You know, like Jesus said, you know, love your enemies, pray for them, do good to those who hate you, turn the other cheek, etc. Dr. Brooke highlighted psychology a lot. He quoted John Gottman, who's very big in the relationships literature, and talked about the dangers of contempt. He called it contempt. I think in social psychology, we'd more go for dehumanization. But basically, the idea of hating your enemy, seeing them as less than you, how that won't lead to a flourishing political society. And what Dr. Brooks said was he gave us three action items in his speech. You know, he said to love your enemies, even when it's difficult. Ask God to help you do so, or at least to help you fake it if you can't go all the way to loving them. He said to reject contempt for your enemies. And third, to answer contempt from others with love. You know, love them, pray for them, do good for those who hate you. And President Trump immediately began his speech by questioning this and saying, I'm not sure I agree with you. And then saying he basically actively does not agree with Dr. Brooks. He conflated his impeachment with the oppression of Christianity, taking what many have interpreted as a veiled jab at Mitt Romney, saying that, you know, his opponents who voted for his impeachment knew what they were doing was wrong, and he's not sure he can forgive them. He called out people who say they pray for him when he knows that's not so, which is probably a jab at Pelosi. Again, it's certainly been taken as such. Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said she prays for President Trump. And then he turned the rest of his speech basically into your typical Trumpian backpatting and campaign stump speaking. I mean, all the things you'd expect. You know, faith is well alive and well in America. He said that a couple of times. He waved around the newspaper saying he was acquitted. He made a comparison, and I have tried every way to be charitable with this, so you can yell at me, David, if you think I'm being uncharitable. He compared his impeachment to the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ.
That's a rough one. Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of defending that particular facet of what he had to say on during this.
Well,
week,
at least so. I'm not imagining that he made the comparison. And then he said, you know, when they impeach you for nothing, then you're supposed to like them. It's not easy, folks, but I do my best, which doesn't seem to be much. And then he just, it closed with what I would call collective narcissism. You know, the idea that we were not respected as a nation just a few years ago. We had lost our way. Our country is respected again by everybody. It's thanks to me. Aren't I so wonderful? Trump 2020. And a lot of people have been ticked. Some people in the evangelical community, which, as we discussed last time, your connection to evangelicalism is tenuous, perhaps. But a lot of people in Christendom just en masse have really been defending this. But a lot of people have also been ticked, basically saying that, you know, David Crary wrote this for Time Magazine and Michael Gerson wrote something similar for The Washington Post, that Trump is basically just manipulating Christians, especially evangelicals, for the purpose of self-aggrandizement and self-promotion. And if this isn't enough to convince them to abandon him, we are in a dark space indeed.
Which, how many times have we been there before where we've had that exact thought of, if this doesn't convince evangelical Christians, then, you know, what else can be said? So, you know, at the end of the day, we know what the reaction to this is going to be, with a few voices kind of, you know, voicing protest and then the rest of the group kind of moving on with business as usual. But this did seem like it was a bit much. I mean, the National Day of Prayer, you know, going back historically, is supposed to be one of those moments where you're focused on bringing the country together. You're trying to kind of, you know, make an appeal to a common religious framework that's enjoyed in America. And this was nothing short of just a victory lap. I mean, this was basically, you know, pointing to the scoreboard after the acquittal. And you kind of would have hoped that somebody in the administration would have pointed out that that theme is maybe clashing with the way that this prayer breakfast has been used in the past. But I mean, here we are. So we got a victory lap, and we got a strange clash of ideas between the speaker's emphasis and then the emphasis of the president subsequently. But at least he was honest with us and said, you know, that he wasn't sure if he agreed with the thrust of the initial speaker's
speech. What do you think about what Dr. Brooks said, the idea that the answer to partisanship is loving our enemies, turning the other cheek? Do you think that was a good message? Do you think that even is a good understanding of Christianity? Would you, if somebody came to you and was asking for a solution, do you think your remarks or your solution would resemble what he said in his address on the National Day of Prayer? Or
I thought that Dr. Brooks's speech was really effective for a number of reasons. And I think number one is, if there's one thing to take away from Christianity, or if you want to say one idea that defines Christianity, at least in the public consciousness, right? It's this, you know, idea of loving, you know, your neighbor as yourself. And I think he took that and he, I would say, played with that idea in a really interesting way, because he brought up this idea of contempt as a psychological phenomenon, where you're not actually focused on winning others to your side, getting them to see your point of view, and ultimately convincing hearts and minds to what you have to say. But contempt treats your political enemy as less than, as subhuman, as that which is to be kind of, you know, won over and then thrown away. And so I think that Dr. Brooks was speaking to, or trying to offer Christianity as an alternative, perhaps, to the kind of tribalism that we've kind of become used to in American political discourse. And this is something that, you know, is always, I would say, talked about in the church. I think a lot of people say, you know, look at the Christian church, and globally, it's one of the most diverse bodies on earth. You know, people from all different walks of life and, you know, ethnicities and cultures, et cetera, but they find common cause in the teachings of Christ. And that usually is the emphasis of the prayer breakfast. And so I think he was really honing in on, or maybe not honing in on isn't the right word, but he was, I would say, very effectively tapping into both the theme of the day and the theme more broadly of kind of Christianity and a Christianity that is in many people's minds. And certainly, again, this was an apt time to do it, coming off of the acquittal. If there's any time for, if you want to say, a ministry of reconciliation, maybe, it would be after a big, ugly, knockdown, drag-out fight like we just saw play out in the House and the Senate. So in many ways, I felt that Dr. Brooks's speech was very timely.
Well, yeah, that does seem to be the message of what Dr. Brooks was trying to say. And from at least my reading of Christian teaching, I think he's hit the nail on the head. He's certainly a devout Roman Catholic, and he's not trying to hijack the lessons or message of a religion in which he doesn't believe to force his own political agenda. I thought he was actually remarkably nonpartisan. And it really spoke to me because it's something we talk about on the podcast all the time is, you know, partisanship requires coming together and finding common ground and respecting each other. And I really liked his message.
Well, and there is a difficulty that's there too that I think he highlighted. So, you know, loving one's enemy, okay, we hear this all the time, and it's kind of in the cultural, you know, kind of vocabulary, but that actually does require what feels like kind of crossing over a line of division. And so when he talked about this idea of the contempt that's developed for one's enemies, well, that really emphasizes, or we could say re-emphasizes, the radicalness of what Jesus calls us to do. Is it's not just tolerate the enemy, it's not just, you know, sit across the room from them in church, but to actually love one's enemy and actually bridge that gap. And I think that was why, you know, talking about kind of the reaction from this National Day of Prayer and prayer breakfast that was held, I was surprised by a lot of pastors that I saw, you know, across the religious spectrum that basically said, you know, Trump was treated poorly from day one, and I wouldn't shake this person's hand, you know, with the example of Nancy Pelosi from the State of the Union, if I was treated that badly. So can we really blame him? And, you know, in one sense, stepping back, okay, yeah, we can say that he was treated poorly from day one. You know, I agree on that. There were a certain percentage of politicians that wanted to get the, you know, removal process underway. But that's the point as far as the loving your enemies bit, is it is difficult. And that's the challenge that Christ offers us, is that we have to actually do something that involves, in some sense, sacrificing our pride. And we have to, in some sense, die to ourselves in order to reconcile, again, a supposed enemy to ourselves. And again, politically, I thought that resonated very strongly.
So what would you think about Trump's response? Do you think the outrage that, admittedly, many at best nominal Christians or cultural Christians are feeling about this, people are saying he's hijacking the day of prayer. But even in devout Christians, I've seen the response be, this is not Christian behavior from President Trump. His speech was totally unacceptable. Will this be the straw that breaks the camel's back for his evangelical support? And I'm willing to bet no, honestly. But do you think it should be another thing that counts against him? Because, I mean, last time you were on, you said, you know, the response to Trump should be to be thankful when he's nice to us, be thankful when he does something good, but at least slap the wrist when he does something bad. So what should the Christian response be to what President Trump said? Do you think there was a problem with it? Do you think it reflects Christian behavior?
Yeah, I think as far as, you know, thinking about the prayer breakfast historically, you brought up those examples of, you know, Ben Carson speaking with at Barack Obama's prayer breakfast. And, you know, you talked about Mother Teresa speaking at Bill Clinton's. And, it, you know, it's one of those things where as far as maybe slam dunks go, one would think that the prayer breakfast would be as close to a slam dunk politically as you can get. You can invite somebody in who, you might even disagree with. It's a great photo op to show how we've, you know, brought people together in this, you know, nice kind of respite from, you know, the political mudslinging and whatnot. And I think, again, as far as like speakers go, that was the goal. And then it didn't play out that way because, again, the whole thing came across very much as a victory lap. There was swipes taken at political opponents. And really, it just felt like, unfortunately, the president couldn't really help himself as far as this goes. So as far as we would say politically, it didn't seem like it was a smart move. But then for Christians who are looking at this prayer breakfast as kind of a reaffirmation of kind of an evangelical support that's at work in the White House, I think they were hopefully, and you know, again, myself included, surprised and shocked at what was said, especially as far as the comments that were aimed at Senator Romney and at Representative Pelosi. But unfortunately, it's going to be another situation, I think, of people saying, yeah, gee, that's pretty bad. He probably shouldn't have said that. But, you know, he's going to give us some things that we want politically. So we're going to kind of turn... maybe not turn the other cheek. We're going to turn our eyes away from what it is that we're seeing and hearing, which is unfortunate. Because again, this is another moment in a long line of moments wherein we see how the president's support for evangelical Christians is directly tied to whether or not they're going to turn out for him.
So you do think that there was a problem, or that Christians should have a problem with what Donald Trump said in his address on the day of prayer?
Right. I mean, and I would say, you know, regardless of what one thinks about, you know, Nancy Pelosi's particular brand of Christianity that she adheres to, it's not difficult to, again, you know, use that moment to, or use the focus on our common faith values in this country to try to bridge the gap and provide a moment of healing politically. So I do think it was a problem that he decided to take those swipes and call into question the faith of other people with whom he disagrees. I think that, again, Christians need to wrestle with that. And hopefully there's, you know, somebody in the White House who can maybe take the president to the side and kind of use the moment to teach, right? And to hopefully instruct and inform him about using moments like that to build good rapport between those who we disagree with. Because again, talk about, you know, that's a slam dunk moment to do that. At a prayer breakfast, and it was unfortunately, I think, basically kind of bungled. So, yeah. for lack of a better word.
So, staying with the prayer breakfast for at least a little bit, one thing that's been brought up is, you know, President Trump recently became the first president to appear personally at the March for Life, and pro-life has been a single issue that has largely kept many Christians, evangelical or not, in the right wing or voting Republican at the very least. And a couple people have highlighted that when President Trump spoke at the March for Life, he was very positive. Whatever you may think of him personally, if you're a pro-life person, there wasn't much to object to about what he said. I mean, you could definitely look beneath the veneer and see how he was still trying to turn it into a campaign speech. But at the very least, he was at least trying to be classy, and he was trying to keep it as a positive affirmation of beliefs that he's, in the worst case, you could say, trying to manipulate, but he's at least trying to speak nicely to them. And I can't help but note a severe contrast with how he behaved at the National Prayer Breakfast. And I wonder if you might have any idea as to why there might be that disconnect, because you'd think that, you know, at a very, I won't say largely evangelical, because there's a huge Catholic contingent of the March for Life, but at the very least, an explicitly Christian event like the March for Life, he manages to stay kind of classy. He doesn't compare himself and his impeachment to Jesus Christ being nailed to a cross and being scourged and beaten. He manages to keep himself out of it, at least kind of, compared to this prayer breakfast. Do you think there's a reason he might have felt safer turning the prayer breakfast essentially into a campaign speech as opposed to the March for Life? And do you think there's something Christians should take or see or be wary of with that?
Well, I mean, the comparison between the two, I think, is really interesting, because this is why, again, the people in the campaign are really, I think, kind of cued into what drives the base of the Republican Party. And the pro-life march is a huge moment for, again, Christian voters, especially on the right. And so I think the difference in response that you saw, I think, has to do with audience. So at the prayer breakfast, you know, you do have a mixed crowd there. And I think when you've got political opponents, at least in the vicinity, there's this kind of impulse from the president to fight, right? He's a fighter and he's going to take it to his political opponents. And, you know, again, while it was a little bit more subdued at the prayer breakfast compared to an out and out Trump rally, I think that kind of, if you want to say, egged him on a little bit there to kind of score some points, kind of beating up on his opponents. But, you know, the Right to Life march, that's a group that is pretty firmly on his side. I mean, that's the big selling point for the Trump administration has been, he's given us two Supreme Court justices who are pro-life. Look at all the federal judges he's appointed, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that allowed him to be more kind of rah-rah. But I think that what people don't necessarily understand, at least kind of in, I had to say, but like in the media, is how big the Right to Life march is in the minds of Christians. I mean, Christians, this is one of the main events of the year for politically engaged Christians. And it's always this kind of event that's been sort of underground for the longest time. It grew up over the course of, you know, basically 50 years. And, you know, the media never really acknowledged it. They might mention it in passing, and even presidents didn't out and out acknowledge it. You know, I think that they had sent speakers along the way at various points, but President Trump appearing in person to speak to the March for Life, that was just a recognition beyond what anyone could have hoped for inside of the pro-life movement. So again, you do have this contrasting image between the two, where you've got Trump kind of behaving badly at the prayer breakfast, and certainly that's an event that they care about, but I think this is why it's not going to matter at the end of the day in terms of support amongst Christians, is because, again, this recognition of the Right to Life march is so much bigger than anything. There's nothing even akin to that in the minds of Christians on the right. So it was very politically smart and savvy play to have him speak there, because now I think he gives him a lot of wiggle room when inevitable goofs and gaffes happen, like what happened at the prayer breakfast.
Fair enough. I do have one more question about the prayer breakfast, and that is, a lot of Republican senators, when they voted to acquit him, many, not all, but many of them did say that they thought his conduct was unbecoming of the president, and that they hoped that this would be kind of enough of a slap on the wrist that he would behave better. The debate doesn't seem to have been over whether Trump acted inappropriately. It seems to have been over whether or not this is worth impeaching him over, which, I mean, at least that's a better debate than, oh, is this okay? Like, because everyone at least is acknowledging this behavior isn't okay, thank God.
Yeah, this is more about a political decision than it was about whether or not, yeah, it was a perfect phone call, as some like to insist.
It was a beautiful phone call. But one thing that's been picked up and said by people critiquing President Trump at the prayer breakfast has been that, you know, this event happened very soon after his acquittal, mere days after it, and they take it as a sign that he has learned nothing. They say that he basically has showed himself totally impenitent. He really doesn't see himself as being anything other than a victim. I will say, basically, as the slightest of personal philosophy, they do seem to have a point if his first instinct is comparing himself and his impeachment to, again, the scourging and murder by crucifixion of Jesus Christ. But do you think that what he said warrants that interpretation, that he seems to have learned nothing, that he thinks he can do no wrong, that he feels no penitence for what he did, and that, if anything, we can expect worse behavior from him in the future?
Well, I mean, this is the president is a reality TV star, first and foremost. So this whole impeachment process has given him a tremendous platform for spectacle.
And I think, you know, you kind of saw it in his face when he was able to hold up the Trump acquitted headline from the Washington Post. But this isn't just like, oh, I've been given permission. This is, look how we've been able to play this into ratings gold. So while well-meaning Republican senators have been hoping that this is kind of a reality check, saying, you know, maybe we should kind of clean up the behavior in the White House and hopefully kind of rein it in as far as our kind of disregard for the processes that we have for diplomatic relations at the very least, none of that plays into the ratings element of this. So I think that the president, it doesn't seem like he's learned a whole lot. Again, it seems like he's kind of on the victory lap of this whole ordeal, but this does seem to have given him kind of a new lease on life to continue the kinds of things that made him popular with his base before, because that's what the election is going to be all about. It's going to be about kind of churning out the base, and when he's able to get up there and show off the acquittal and say some pejorative things about, you know, opponents, I mean, that goes over very well with the base, for better or worse. But it has been interesting to see the different reaction between those very much on Team Trump and with maybe the Republican senators who are a bit more measured in their response, including, I thought what was very interesting was Mitt Romney's response, because obviously he is the only senator to vote in favor of convicting the president on the charge of abuse of power, not on obstruction of Congress. But one of the things that he cited in his speech that he got to give before casting his vote was his deeply rooted Mormon faith. He mentioned how he tries to live his life in accordance with his religious values, and that because he does that, he could not in good conscience, both serving the people of Utah and, you know, trying to live out his faith, vote to acquit the president. And obviously the president had his veiled remark about Senator Romney, who in Trump's words, you know, didn't care about faith issues until this point. And what I found very interesting was the number of people that I saw echoing that sentiment of, this is Senator Romney using his faith as a crutch or as a tool to really justify the fact that, you know, he's a squish politically in their eyes. But, you know, 2012 wasn't all that long ago. And if you think way back to the campaign then, it's very interesting because one of the central points that the Romney administration or the potential Romney administration was trying to make was how deeply rooted his Christian faith, in their words, was and is to him, and that this influences the way he views obviously pro-life issues and marriage issues and, you know, everything top to bottom, judicial philosophy, et cetera, et cetera. And I even remember having conversations with Christian friends of mine who were concerned about the degree that he held to his Mormon faith, because there are theological differences between Mormonism and mainline kind of Christianity. So I guess the claim you can't make is that Mitt Romney doesn't care about faith-based issues. This is always who Mitt Romney has been going back historically. So I was really kind of shocked to see that part called into question, even though, you know, even with the understanding that obviously he committed the unforgivable sin of creating a bipartisan vote to convict the president on at least one of those charges. But the reaction to that has just been fascinating, at least to me.
Well, it's very interesting because a lot of the defense of President Trump from the Christian slash evangelical, however you want to split that up. Yeah. A lot of that defense has been basically that, well, Trump's learning, but at least his heart's in the right place. You can't know his heart. You know, that's the big thing. You can't know the president's heart. You can't know what he's thinking. And I mean, obviously, the relationship between the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and I guess we can say Orthodox Christianity, small o, has been rocky at best. I mean, certainly it's better now than in the mid-19th century when they were trying to kill each other. But it's interesting to me that the litmus test seems to be support of Trump or support of this collective identity. You know, and the same thing is being said about Speaker Pelosi. You know, no one's bringing up that Speaker Pelosi you know, she is pro-choice. She is virulently pro-choice. That would be a doctrinal reason to question her faith, perhaps. There are doctrinal reasons to say why the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its split-offs should not count as Christian. But that doesn't seem to be what people are bringing up. They're accusing Romney of all sorts of motives and double dealings and all this idea is like he's still angry that he's not the nominee and he's just corrupt, yada, yada, yada. And admittedly, I don't like Romney politically. I didn't vote for him in 2012. It was the first election presidentially I could vote for, and I didn't. It didn't have anything to do with him being Mormon. It just had to do with him being a centrist. I voted for Ron Paul. But it just seems interesting to me that there's a double standard there. You know, President Trump can say whatever the heck he wants and violate what seems like very fundamental Christian beliefs. I mean, the Sermon on the Mount is, by my understanding, a fundamental and central Christian doctrine, and yet Trump violates it, and even in this case has actively basically said he doesn't agree with it. And the defense is you can't judge his heart. But then Romney says that his faith is what leads him to vote to condemn Trump on only one of the multiple articles of impeachment. And the only support he's really getting from even close to his own side is from Justin Amash, who says you'll never regret going for faith in your conscience over party. And that does that seem like a double standard to you? Because it really seems like a double standard to me.
Yeah, I definitely think there's an element of there being a double standard there for sure. And I think you're right on the money as far as this kind of strange, if you want to say, mental gymnastics that's kind of happening, wherein Trump might do the things we want him to do politically, so we're going to give him a pass. And again, putting aside the theological, well-established theological differences between these various other church bodies like the Mormons and mainline Christianity. But again, that Mitt Romney is kind of on the record as far as being an active member of his church. I believe he was, an elder or some sort of equivalent as far as a leader in the Mormon church there. And obviously Nancy Pelosi is, there are certainly issues with what her church might say on a particular issue and the way she acts politically. Those are definitely, we're not papering over that. Those are huge problems that people have to wrestle with, but they're pretty dyed in the wool as far as what their religious beliefs are. And so this kind of calling into question what they believe on the basis of going against the Trump consensus is definitely, I think, a little bit hypocritical as far as that's concerned. So yeah, I think that we basically have a standard of orthodoxy, which has somewhat shifted compared to years past, where instead of it being instead of receiving a pass on orthodoxy stemming from one's doctrinal beliefs, we actually have kind of a standard of orthodoxy that comes from how one acts and operates politically. And again, I think this is where for those of us who are concerned about this in the church, you know, obviously our religious beliefs, of course, influence the way we think politically and influence the way that we vote. But ideally, I would like to see more voices kind of defending, you know, those with both whom we disagree, such as, you know, Speaker Pelosi and then obviously Mitt Romney. But in addition to that, also kind of holding to account some of the rhetoric that's coming out of the right towards those with whom they disagree.
Well, there's been this idea in psychology that I'd love to run by you because I've been getting into it both as a matter of research and trying to generate new projects, because that's what every grad student needs is another project to run, but also as a form of analysis. It's the idea of collective narcissism, and to anyone in the audience who is of Slavic, especially Polish background, I apologize for how I'm about to butcher this psychologist's name. No matter how many Witcher books I read or Witcher games I play, it hasn't helped my Polish. But Dr. Agnieszka Golak-Dzewala, she's come up with the idea of collective narcissism. And I want to read you a quote from an article she wrote for laymen. It's not a research article. And this is what I see as kind of starting to be that new standard of orthodoxy for the Christian church. So I'd love to see your view on it, at least as far as, when I mean a standard of orthodoxy, I mean politically. And she calls it collective narcissism. Quote, collective narcissists exaggerate offenses to their group's image and respond to them aggressively. Collective narcissists believe that their group's importance and worth are not sufficiently recognized by others. They feel that their group merits special treatment and insist that it gets the recognition and respect it deserves. In other words, collective narcissism amounts to a belief in the exaggerated greatness of one's group and demands external validation. Collective narcissists are not simply content to be members of a valuable group. They don't devote their energy to contributing to the group's betterment and value. Rather, they engage in monitoring whether everybody around, particularly other groups, recognize and acknowledge the great value and special worth of their group. To be sure, collective narcissists demand privileged treatment, not equal rights, and the need for continuous external validation of the group's inflated image, a negative attribute, is what differentiates collective narcissists from those who simply hold positive feelings about their group. When their own group is involved, collective narcissists have no sense of humor. They are disproportionately punitive in responding to what they perceive as an insult to their group, even when the insult is debatable, not perceived by others, or not intended by the other group. Unlike individual narcissists, collective narcissists cannot dissociate themselves from an unpopular or criticized group. Once their self-worth is invested in the greatness of their group, collective narcissists are motivated by enhancing their group rather than themselves. End quote. That's what I'm kind of seeing in this new evangelical support of Trump. It's not just, hey, he's going to get us the judges. Hey, he's advancing the pro-life agenda. Hey, we genuinely think he's pro-religion. It's all bound up in this idea of he's going to make people respect Christianity again. He's going to keep "In God We Trust" on the currency. He's going to put prayer back in schools. That awful t-shirt slogan, I stand for the flag and I kneel for the cross.
Coming to a shopping mall near you.
Well, I'm in Oklahoma, so it's probably already in the mall. But to me, this seems to be the new standard of orthodoxy, and I think you see that really in the number of people who have applauded Trump from the Christian right, evangelical and otherwise. It's not about love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, pray for those who spitefully use and persecute you. It's about these people have insulted Christianity as we see it, and we have the right, nay, the obligation, to be nasty as heck to them. And to me, that seems to be what the evangelical right is becoming. It's becoming collective narcissism, and it's just about the identity of being quote-unquote religious. It's not about religious teaching. And in such an ideological perspective, what actually makes someone religious, the actual teaching, is left by the wayside in favor of just punching down at those who we see as our enemies.
Right, right. And I think that that's, I think that's spot on. I mean, I do see that rather than it being a, you know, we'll take what we can get politically, it's kind of a one for me, one for you kind of thing. So, you know, the president promises to put prayer back in public schools, and there are some Christians that would see that as a big win. So therefore, they feel like they have to do one for him and not just hold their nose and vote for him, but rather kind of really imbibe the Trumpism movement. And I think that's why you really do see a very stern backlash when you criticize the president amongst a certain group of those on the right, Christians included, because it's this view of, again, this kind of two-way street where because he's done something for us, now we're going to do something for him and fight for him as part of our now newfound collective group identity. And all the while, again, some of these core Christian teachings and values, just in terms of how we relate to one another, I think are kind of left by the wayside. And that's where, you know, I think we should be a little bit uncomfortable with this, because again, if you look at that, not to go back to Dr. Brooks's speech, but I will for a moment, he talked about this idea of contempt being an issue there, and I think plays into the collective narcissist idea as well, where it's not really about winning hearts and minds anymore, and it's not about trying to win your brother, right, as Jesus says in the Gospels, but instead it's about winning, getting one over and ultimately making your opponent look small because of this, you know, if you want to say existential ideological warfare that many Christians feel like they're fighting. And I was thinking with this collective narcissist idea, I think there's that might help explain why so many of the inputs that we would expect to derail, a campaign like the president's end up not doing so. Because I think if you can take, I call it nut picking. So if you can take one nut from the other side of the political aisle and make that to be, or show them to be demonstrative of the overall political ideology, then you've really created an us versus them dynamic where you are all of a sudden fighting for your right to even just exercise your faith. And so a really good example of this being when Dianne Feinstein had her confrontation with a Christian judicial appointee, and she certainly had reservations about the way in which one's Christian faith would influence judicial policy. And it seemed to be that she was indicating that if you're a Christian and you hold to your faith seriously, you're not going to really be counted for that, you know, for a position or for a major role like that. And I think that people's reaction obviously was they were appalled by what Dianne Feinstein had to say, because that violates basic civil liberties. But then to take what she said and say that is the entirety of your political opposition, I think that's the step that's made that's a step too far. And maybe this, again, goes back to this idea of, political narcissism being that if there's any sort of attack on the group, what you're actually attacking is our core identity of both Christianity and now the newfound identity we have in the president.
Yeah, and you have even more insidiously the idea that it is just the identity. It's just the name. It's not about the doctrines or the beliefs that you hold. And I don't think this necessarily even has to be a religious issue, because look at what Trump has done to the label of conservatism. I mean, Russell Kirk, or really pick any of your classic conservative figures, Buckley Jr., anyone would be appalled by what he stands for. And yet, I mean, I get emails from both the Democratic and Republican parties. It's hilarious in both cases. And, you know, one of the things that's a very common theme in the White House and the RNC's emails is this is an assault on conservative values. And I'm like, I'm not a conservative. I am principially not. I have much in common, but I also have much in difference. But I flatter myself, I at least understand the basics of the ideology. And where big government, anti-free trade, surveillance state, red flag laws, abject, blatant, and petulant disregard for due process play into conservatism is beyond me. But because Trump takes that label of conservatism, turns it into collective narcissism, and plays off of that, it doesn't matter about the ideology anymore. It just matters about the label. And now we're just fighting over labels. It is truly the most absurd fight you could have, because the differences between the two wings of political ideology, those differences are becoming less and less and less. It is literally just about the names. It's becoming more and more just about Team Red and Team Blue, not about issues or principles.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue of kind of tribalism that's cropped up. But isn't that interesting too? Because you mentioned this recrafting of the conservative image that's happened over the past few years. But you know, you mentioned you're not a conservative. Well, technically, neither is Trump, right? I mean, like, he himself said, "I'm not a conservative. I'm a nationalist." But what I find so fascinating about this kind of Team Red, Team Blue dynamic is that even though the president has come out and pretty publicly, I don't know if you want to say disavowed conservatism, but that's certainly not his main identity. His main identity is in nationalism. He himself is a populist, but it's this willingness of the Republican Party, which since the years of Ronald Reagan has always been a conservative movement, but now they've been able to kind of keep the conservative title, but it's been rebranded to match the president's particular form of political ideology. Which, again, is just so fascinating. Normally, a Republican candidate is trying to convince people that he's the most conservative candidate. And this is one guy who says, I'm not conservative, I'm a nationalist. And yet everything around him has been rebranded to, if you want to say, fit this kind of political figure into the Team Red ethos, right? And so it is kind of strange to see, and it's not just mental gymnastics, but the way in which the party is really adapted to meet this person, because he is the one who's perceived as the fighter, the champion, who's going to, you know, reinstill all those values that you know, right-leaning individuals hold dear, kind of thing. Not that I agree with that, but that's, I think, the thought.
Yeah, and then it's definitely scary. But I don't think we've seen the end of it, unfortunately. I think as we head into this 2020 election season, as New Hampshire comes up in a few days, as Iowa has already passed us, and the Fakakta situation.
Are the results in from Iowa yet, or are they still counting?
As of recording this, I think they're finally in at like 97% or 98%, but who the heck knows? Maybe New Hampshire will be better.
Long, long political journey from here, and I guarantee you this isn't going to be the first time we're talking about issues like this. So
I think we'll also see that idea, because I don't think it's just the right that feels it. I think you're seeing it in the left as well. And while I think the prayer breakfast should be emblematic and troubling for people who have an ideological foot in the race or stake in the game, however you want to put it, I think that you'll also see this on the left, as they don't really have an identity either. It's just the anti-Trump movement. And as the people who are running for office shift farther and farther left, we'll see how that turns out.
Yeah, but we'll see the same thing there too. That's an important point to bring up, is that whoever the nominee is on the left, we will see, I think, not necessarily political realignment, but there'll be a big movement to rebrand the whole of the party into the image of whoever the nominee is, because again, it's not just a phenomenon on the right. I think this kind of personality driven politics and this kind of, you know, sacrifice everything for the sake of the candidate, it's going to happen on the left as well as we head down the stretch here to 2020, once we have an idea of who the candidate's going to be. So might as well buckle in, because we have, this phenomenon isn't going away in either political party. It's here for the long run.
Well, to quote something you said last episode and expand on it, as we move towards the November election, keep your powder dry, and I would expand, and keep your alcohol wet. You know, that's all you can do. But David, thanks so much for coming on to the podcast. This has been a lot of fun, and it's always great to have a chance to talk the world of religion, because it's, for better or worse, the city of God and the city of man are way too close, as Augustine would say.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. This is great. I look forward to being on the podcast again at some point in the future. So thank you so much.
Our Costco, Richard John Neuhaus, will be back. Meanwhile, if you have any thoughts about the prayer breakfast, about either of the speakers at it, President Trump or Dr. Brooks, you think we're being unfair to Trump, you think there's something we should have brought up, do feel free to send us a message on Facebook at Liberty Snark, or you can send us an email at contact@libertysnarkpodcast.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you guys next week. Take care, guys. Thanks for listening to the Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Snarkiness podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider giving us a like or a share on social media, or leaving us a review on the podcasting platform of your choice. You can reach us at our Facebook at Liberty Snark, or visit our website at libertysnarkpodcast.com. Thank you guys so, so much for listening.